Hi, this is Helen Hebert, and I'm in Iowa with Tim Barrett. I'll let him tell us where we are because it's kind of long. So, and Tim, I just want to say that I don't think you remember when we first met, but I do because I was a young young person, and you meet so many of us. And it was in Boston at the Peabody when the Japanese papermakers came over.
Yeah.
I think Lauren Perlman organized
that.
Yeah,
I remember that.
And it was fantastic to see. They brought all of their equipment, all of this fiber.
Yeah.
And now here I am for the first time seeing your facility.
Yeah. What I remember about that event was lying in bed at night in the wee hours of the morning in the hotel listening to the Japanese papermakers in the floor below and having a complete drunken soiree, yelling and screaming and feeling responsible because I was helping to host them, but not feeling responsible enough to go down here and try it in Japanese and try to break up the party.
Oh, right. So, anyways, so what's the name of the facility here?
The long version would be UI Center for the Book, Research and Production Paper Facility.
Right. Great. And so I just want to ask you about how you got started with paper. What was the seed? When was the seed planted?
I think probably when I was about 15 or 16. I mean, I grew up as a teenager enjoying making things with my hands, just building stuff. And I asked my father at one point how paper was made before the paper machine. He was a professor of English and American literature and knew enough about the history of books to be able to describe this rectangular sieve-like device, and I thought the whole thing sounded really intriguing. And turns out Kalamazoo, Michigan was a paper town, and it had something to do with me getting started in this, because when I needed pieces of old machine felt or forming fabric, there were local folks who did help me. But it wasn't until I was in high school that I really started to snoop around in the library, found Dart Hunter's books, and that was a big deal for me when I found those books and realized that it was like opening the door to Alibaba's cavern. It wasn't suddenly to be curious about handmade paper was not just, you know, odd. Here's somebody who really devoted his life to pursuing this, and not only that, but it was way more deep and broad and complicated and fascinating than I'd ever dreamed. And so, I visited Larry Barker, who was making paper at the Green Book Art Academy, and that was important. Made a little bit of paper in a shop that I set up for myself at Antioch College in the early 70s. And then went and worked with Kathy and Howie Clark at Twin Rocker, and from there went on to the Fulbright in Japan. And so that's the early part of the story.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about going to Japan, and because I write how-to books, your book really influenced me. You know, I looked, book writing for me came about by accident. So I'm just wondering how you approached, how did you approach it? How did you come up with your style for writing? And it's so detailed and friendly.
Whether I'm writing an article or a book, I always start off by asking myself, all right, if I were reading either, what would I like to find?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of information would I like to have?
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, I always recommend Suki Hughes' book in combination with mine, because Suki covers a lot of the kind of cultural craft aesthetic context for papermaking, and she does a great job of it. I wasn't particularly interested in it. I was interested in, okay, how does this actually work? How does this process function, number one? And number two, what would you do if you actually wanted to do it? This is one of the few shortcomings of Dart Hunter. You can read through all those books and you think, my goodness, what a lot of detail. But then when you ask yourself, how do I do it? There's nothing there. There's nothing there about a beating degree and beating tackle and how do the Asians actually cook their raw fiber? What kind of alkali do they use and what's concentrations and so on? So my approach to Japanese papermaking was really focused on being able to do it, because I wanted people to be able to do it, but also I figured if I can't explain how to do this, and if I can't do it myself, then I really don't understand it.
Right.
I really
sure.
haven't.
Yeah.
I really haven't gotten to the bottom of it.
Right. So. Right. And so you mentioned Suki Hughes. Her book is called Washi, and came out before.
Washi, the world of Japanese paper, I think. Yeah.
It came out before.
A little. Yeah. That's
just
right.
A little.
Few years before mine.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Uh huh. So you were in Japan, and then you came back to America.
Right.
And then just tell me the transition to coming to Iowa.
So I came back from Japan after having spent a couple of years under a Fulbright.
Did the book come about?
Well, Henry Morris, when I was in Japan, he was a friend and a real supporter, and I had been sending him letters with some of these stories. You know?
He's in Seattle?
Henry was in Philadelphia at the time.
Okay.
He was printing limited edition books, often usually about the history of the craft. And he said during this correspondence, you know, you should keep track of all this stuff. This could make a good book someday. And I didn't really pay much attention to it. Not a thing in my head about ever writing a book, let alone getting a job at a university. But I did keep notes, and when I came back, I put it together, and Richard Flavin agreed to do the drawings. And so Henry and I kind of worked this out by correspondence, and so he printed the first book, which was limited edition, and then I got a grant from NEA. I think, seems to me it was $5,000 or $10,000 to redo the manuscript to include the hands-on portion, and that then became the trade edition that Weatherhill did.
Okay.
And
the trade edition was hardback, still?
Initially, it was
so
hardback.
So I haven't seen the initial edition.
Yeah.
And then it was paperback. Yeah.
Right. And okay. There were a couple of editions that had actual samples in the front.
Uh-huh.
Possibly one paperback edition with samples, and then it's just straight paperback version.
Right.
And I'm hoping to do a book, a complimentary book on Western papermaking soon, sometime in the next year or two, that
great.
Would be, take a similar tack. You know? I've been itching to write it, and I just haven't been able to get around to it. So,
wonderful.
But you were asking about the transition from Japan to here, how I ended up here at the University of Iowa. So I came back from Japan. I had a Japanese mold and Sue and some Japanese fiber and a camera and three lenses and lots of Japanese paper samples and no money in the bank.
Right.
You know? So then it was like, well, what am I going to do now?
Uh-huh.
So at the same time I was building a shop, a workspace in my parents' barn in Kalamazoo, I did these two national lecture tours, and I had no intention of trying to get my name out there. I really just felt I needed to share this process, which I've learned.
So where did you go? What kind of places? Japan, society?
Well, it was more art schools,
art
museums.
Okay.
I sent out letters, and eventually would go around and do like 30 stops during a 3-month period. And that brought in enough money to sort of last part of the way through the rest of the year, but that, the wolf was really at the door. I mean, it was very, very difficult. I was trying to make paper and sell it, and that wasn't amounting to very much at all. And about this time, Kim Merker here at the University of Iowa, unbeknownst to me, was trying to create a center for the book. And he was working with the administration to create a position for a book conservator, bookbinding specialist, and for a papermaker, and eventually I got the position here, and, you know, I came in 86 and hit the ground running, and I have never looked back, you know. It's just been absolutely fabulous for me, and I feel extremely lucky and have ever since I arrived.
Right, so let's fast forward 30 years. Here we are today. Can you just give me an overview of the papermaking aspect of your program?
Well, in a way, we kind of fit the model of a university professor in, say, chemistry, where that professor has a lab where he's conducting research and he has grad students who are working with him or her, and because they are really interested in his or her specialty, but they're also thinking about their own research and the path that they want to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And the work that takes place in the lab allows the professor to bring it into the classroom. For me, the research I've done on historical papers here in the research and production facility has allowed me to make changes in the production routines that we use when we produce paper for rare book and art conservation and book arts uses. But the important part of the story is that activity, the analysis of historical papers and the production at this facility impacts the teaching that takes place on the main campus in North Hall, where the other Center for the Book classrooms are. You know, I feel real lucky to be teaching the art and science of the craft that I love. I feel real lucky to have this production and research facility, and I'm just real proud to be associated with the program and this university. It's really been something.
And so what's a typical year of papermaking classes?
Well, in the fall I teach a class in Islamic and Asian style papermaking, which actually starts off with Nepalese style floating mold sheet forming, goes to Islamic style papermaking, then to Japanese. And that includes readings connected with the history of the craft or related aesthetics. And there are two-thirds of the class is kind of focused on assignments, the demonstrations and assignments that I present to the students. And then the last third, they're able to pick a project that they want to do, and it may have a completely artistic tangent. It could be based.
Mm-hmm.
Then we repeat that same format in the spring with Western papermaking. So there's those two key classes.
Right.
And as you know, we've been eager to have summer classes or visitors like you who specialize in paperworks or 2D or 3D techniques in paper, because it's not something that I routinely teach, although the students are often resourceful and go right ahead and do that kind of thing with a lot of encouragement from me. So.
Right. And so you have a two-week or a month-long intensive? Sort of
in the summer, there's a summer class that's often taught by a visitor from off campus. Anne-Marie Kennedy, Mary Hark, Bridget O'Malley are some of the people who've taught that class. It's problematic, though, because our MFA students have to conjure up tuition to be able to take that class. They don't, if they're lucky enough to have a research assistantship where they're tuition is paid for during the regular academic year. That's not the case in the summer. So we've been eager to have more happen during the regular academic year. And so your visit here is important because you're doing this two-day workshop for us and people at least get a taste of what the alternative approaches are.
Nice. And so tell me a little bit about your research.
Yeah.
An overview.
You know, it's funny because there's some of what I do that looks like, oh, he's really interested in the history of the craft, or he's really interested in paper science, and it's true that those things have factor into my research, but my main interest is an aesthetic one. Why do some Japanese papers have a certain kind of luster about them? Why do some of them feel soft and crisp at the same time, and others don't?
Mm-hmm.
Why do certain European papers have a lot of character and integrity? How can they be really tough and strong and supple at the same time? So there are these aesthetic subtleties that really have driven all of the research. And in the course of doing that, science has turned out to be important to helping answer some of those questions. Getting a grip on paper history or historical context has been important. But it's really the aesthetics all along that's kind of driven everything.
Uh-huh. So the look...
Why is one piece of paper, and we'll just eliminate machine-made papers for the moment, why does one piece of handmade paper seem dull and not particularly interesting at all, and another piece of handmade paper seem to be really loaded with its own personality?
Yeah. So do you have an anecdote of something you've researched and... found out, you know, in this investigation?
Well, you know, the early one that often gets repeated, and that some the early story that some people like and others don't is, you know, analyzing these 15th century papers early on. This was in the late 80s for pH and some other characteristics, and sitting there one day and waiting for this pH meter needle to settle down so I could record the pH, and thinking to myself, I don't understand why these papers are so interesting. I really don't think that, I don't know if all this science stuff is going to tell me. And then I noticed up on the upper left-hand corner, there's a thumbprint, you know, from where the layer, almost certainly the layer, picked the damp sheet up off the felt, moved it over to the pile, and went right on to the next one. And I felt like, you know, if I put my thumb in that place, it was like 500 years just kind of disappeared. And so all those little touches of the hand, and even less obvious ones, all the time and effort that went into making the linen cloth, all the times it was washed, all the sorting and the fermentation, all that stuff, all that intimate contact between human beings and the raw material is actually there in the finished paper. So that constitutes a really different piece of paper than one that's made from, say, cotton liners or another raw fiber that's been cooked and bleached elsewhere, that's very carefully made and very refined. Those are two different pieces of paper. They have different histories.
Right, right.
And particularly, they have a different story when it comes to the selection and preparation of the raw material. You know, it boils down to taking a close look at, in both Japanese and in early European papermaking, the raw materials, how they're selected and how they're prepared before you even form a sheet, you know, because that's the essence of the finished paper, kind of.
And I love that thumbprint story. I do love it because it reminds me of, I have some old English molds that I got from Wokey Hole in England, and whenever I use them, I think about who was making paper, how many sheets were made on these.
Yeah.
What were they thinking? It's like you're in a time machine, going back between the centuries.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I think that's one of the attractions to historical artifacts in general, is that they're alive. They have their own story to tell about their interaction with human beings Once you start to learn to read those artifacts, whether it's a book or paper or rocking chairs or something, they turn out to be really loaded with information.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about now, I listened to your podcast with Steve Miller recently, but it like cut off right when you were talking about, this is a little bit different topic, but going to another country, so your experience in Japan and how interacting with people from other countries really is world peace could come from that. I don't remember what you said. Do you remember, you know, having to have the understanding and communicating between cultures?
Well, I don't remember what road I was going down with Steve on that. I mean, it's certainly true that, you know, I remember at one point, this is maybe a completely different track, but I remember at one point when I went to, Nina Takahashi and I went to India as part of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization project to help improve the craft in India. And there was some concern in some quarters in America about the fact we were going to help these people because the price of labor is so cheap over there, and India, papers from India were already flooding the American market. And so I thought to myself, I hadn't gone yet, I was about to go.
Right.
And I thought to myself, I never really thought about that. So I got in touch with one of my teachers in Japan, and I presented this to him because I was being asked to go to India to help share Japanese techniques. And his basic response was, look, don't worry about it. The craft of papermaking hadn't moved all around the world. it would still be stuck in China, you know, and we probably wouldn't even have machine paper making. You know, this is something that's important to human culture all across the globe, and you go right ahead and, you know, teach them whatever you can.
Right.
Now, when I got over there, I was happy to teach things, but I also said, what have you got in the way of Islamic-style papers made in this country?
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't particularly interested in it, but when I started digging into that whole story, it turns out there were fabulous papers, Islamic-style papers.
Right.
And I tried to convince them, you know,
this
you guys
tradition.
Should forget you
yeah.
should forget about Japanese techniques and European techniques. You can make paper like this again. You'll blow the lid right off the international handmade paper market because there's no, these are gorgeous, you know. They're highly burnished and translucent, and, well, they had a different plan. You know, they were interested in what they called technology transfer. They were really interested. So it's, sometimes you need somebody from the outside to act as a mirror and show you what you're right in the middle of yourself.
Right. Right, right. Well, I want to just talk a little about your MacArthur Award. I was honored to be asked to write one of the recommendation letters.
I didn't know that. Thank you.
Uh-huh. And I'm curious just about the process, how you found out, how they told you, and your reflections on receiving that.
Yeah.
Anything you want to share?
It's really, they're very, as you know, they're very secretive about this whole process, and
mm-hmm.
I didn't know it was coming. The only hint that I had was I got this really cryptic message from Asao Shimura in the Philippines, and, you know, everybody's sworn to secrecy, and he sent me an email, and he said, in his cryptic English, it said, big secret. All I say is, you get this. It be very big. A sow. You know, and I thought, I wonder what's going on. But then, you know, I forgot about it, and, you know, it was probably a year and a half later or something. I get this phone call. I'm in a faculty meeting with four of my colleagues. The phone rings. I shut it off in my pocket because I'm in a faculty
right.
meeting. The phone rings again. And I shut it off, and then I get a third call, and I thought, you know, my son's in trouble in high school, or there's an issue here. So I went out in the hallway, and David Sokol, I think his name was, he said, David Sokol, the MacArthur Foundation, are you familiar with MacArthur Fellowships? And I said, oh, yes, indeed. And he said, do you know anyone who's received one? And I said, well, I know Terry Bellinger, who has, and he said, well, there's someone else with the initials TB who's received one. And I said, all right, come on now, you got to help me out here a little bit. What, you know, tell me what the deal is. And he said, well, congratulations, I'm calling to. And then he said, now, you can't tell anyone about this, okay? You can tell one person, your significant other, but you mustn't tell anyone else for another 10 days until we're able to get a news release together and have some photographs taken. So then I go back into the faculty meeting, and everybody goes, what's all that? And I said, oh, nothing. It's like, sorry to interrupt.
Right.
No big deal. And
oh, my God.
So then I called my wife, and she says, you're kidding me. And I said, no, I'm not. I just got this phone call. She said, you're joking. And I said, Jody, you're my wife.
Right.
You know? Believe me, okay? I just got this phone call. She said, this is amazing. I can't believe it. So anyway, it was a really great surprise. In large part, I mean, it was good for me, obviously, on a lot of different levels, the money, the visibility, but it was very important, I think, to the visibility of the program here and to all of the book arts, you know.
Right.
It just, that's one of the wonderful things about the MacArthur, is that an organic farmer can get one of these.
Right.
And an organic farmer without a, you know, terminal degree in anything can get one if he or she is doing something really special.
Right.
And so it's a great organization, and it really helped a lot on a lot of levels.
Cool. Let's just talk a little bit about who you've influenced, who's come through here, what mm-hmm. they're doing today. Pick one or two people you want to tell me about. I know there's many.
Yeah. Well, there are many, and you know, Tatiana Ginsburg and Paul Denhode, really, you know, they ended up going to Japan with different goals in mind, and Steph Rue is now in Korea pursuing the book art. She's kind of following on the heels of Amy Lee, who is not a student of mine. But I think people have realized that there was something special about Tim's experience abroad, number one. And number two, seems like Fulbright's might be more accessible than many people think. Or maybe, you know, if you allow yourself to think, maybe I could get Fulbright. You know, if you don't think that, then it's guaranteed you're not going to get one, because it means you don't try. And so I'm really happy that I've been able to inspire a number, a whole range of people who are going on to do things that I'm never going to have time for. But they're things that they've, Lisa Miles now, is really interested in Mesoamerican beaten bark papers and Indonesian beaten bark papers and stuff. And she's going to, I'm pretty sure, do some great stuff with that, both from a historical craft perspective, but also artistically using it in her own artwork. So, yeah, there's just too many too many people to mention, but it's been a an honor to teach a lot of these people, and they're all inspiring to me, that's for sure. So,
And let's talk a moment just about the. So you, you have a certain interest in history and research, and but there is also an artistic element of hand paper making, and so I kind of just want to talk a little bit about what you know about the other facilities in the country that are teaching papermaking and sort of your colleagues at other institutions and their programs. Just to get an overview of what's happening in America.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we I do think at the Center for the Book here, a lot of the MFA theses tend to be either limited edition artist books or one-of-a-kind artist books. Works of art, but we're really steeped in giving people a background in the history and technique of the various book arts. At the same time, there's a dialogue going on about art making. And that's a real rich kind of substrate of information that, that people can build on. I mean, I do think, say in the world of papermaking, that it's both exciting and dangerous when you go into a workshop or a course and you begin to work creatively with paper pulp right away. There's something very American about that. You know, we don't have a long cultural history, so we just dive into stuff, and that's part of the reason fabulous art and craft even come out of this country. But then again, I think it's real important to be exposed to the history and technique, say, of papermaking at the same time you're experimenting. That's one of the things that characterizes your own work, your interest in that history and technique of the craft. I think it's a good, important thing. So it kind of depends, you know, when people come to visit here, I try not to initially convince them to come here. I try to find out, you know, I ask questions like, do you like living in big cities or small towns? And if they tell me they have an issue with small towns, I say, well, listen, you should look at the Philadelphia program or Chicago. Because Tuscaloosa and Iowa City are small towns. And the reverse sometimes turns out to be the case. They're intimidated by big cities. And so we try to find a little more about what the person really wants to do, and sometimes we end up saying, you know, this place is really a good fit for you. So I think that, you know, I don't know a lot about the coursework and exactly what's going on in Chicago, but they have a beautiful papermaking facility. And a lot of opportunity for, you know, installation, performance-type approaches.
Right, real interdisciplinary, in the arts.
And that's really important. Steve Miller and Anna Embray have a great program in Tuscaloosa that has a real focus on fine press printing and bookbinding and papermaking, and great program there, real inspired mentors. So, you know, it's hard to, I think all of us continue to look to Dudonné as a, you know, a real leader in the field of paperworks. You know, they've for...
Dudonné Paper Mill in New York City.
Yeah. They, for decades now, they've tried to provide an opportunity for artists to work creatively with paper, it's sometimes it's a struggle, you know. People associate paper with craft or what, I don't know, associate it with do-it-yourself stuff that people do on Saturdays. But once they take a look at it, the potential is awesome. And because it has no tradition, that is to say paperworks, I mean, yes, it's linked to the history and technique of the papermaking craft, but because the techniques are literally being invented as we go along, it's not a bad place to be. It's like wide open territory for an artist. It's a very exciting place to be. So same is true of books in a way. You know,
right.
But, so I think it's the potential for the future is really pretty exciting for all of us, even though there aren't a lot of great jobs out there. I think, you know, this sounds crazy, but I think those of us who are specialists at books and paper used in a produced in a traditional way or artistically are going to be real, we're going to be the priesthood of the future,
mm-hmm.
because the digital thing is going to become 100 times more cool than it is right now. Everything's going to go completely holographic.
Right.
And not in 10 or 20 years from now, if you're trying to seduce somebody, you are not going to do it with a hologram. You're going to do it with a handmade piece of paper, hand calligraphed on a specially prepared substrate that has different layers of color worked into it, and that person is going to get that invitation and they're going to come to dinner with you, you know? They're going to say, where did you get this thing?
Right.
And I just think culturally we're going to go through those transitions,
right.
And I think it's going to be very exciting.
Cool. So I just want to wrap up with some of the ways that people can find out about you online, since we're talking or touching paper. You've given me a tour here, and you sell papers. The Center for the Book sells a few papers.
Yeah, they can. The UI Center for the Book, our website's going through a transition right now, so I'm not exactly sure what you're going to encounter, but if you just Google UI Center for the Book, you'll get to our main website, and there's a link to our store where you can buy books and handmade papers. My main research on historical European papers, if you Google Paper Through Time, Barrett, the first thing that comes up is a website that explains a lot of the research on the historical papers.
And of course your book, Japanese Papermaking, I don't know if we said the title.
That's right, that's available through the Center for the Book.
And some videos
around
the website.
There's videos on YouTube if you search Chancery Papermaking. There's a couple videos that will come up that show our Western sheet production. And we actually sell some videos on Western and Japanese papermaking that are available too. So,
great. Yeah. And so just since you mentioned the Chancery papermaking, you told me that you're trying to replicate what was done. You can explain it better than I can in terms of sheet production.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about this, you know, so we spent several, I spent several years going through this non-destructive analysis of 1,500 historical paper samples, really in an attempt, as I mentioned earlier, to get at the aesthetics of these 15th century papers. Why do they seem to be so special? Are they really different, or are they more or less the same when you analyze their chemical content and other characteristics? Well, it turns out they are way different. They have a lot more gelatin in them and a lot more calcium in them than paper made in subsequent centuries. They're thicker.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be lighter in color. Now, what's weird about this, if you're interested in the aesthetics, as I am, if you go ahead and you make papers using that formula, it's not really a complete formula, but let's say you use the, what you've discovered from those analyses, you don't get paper that's special like the old stuff. So the question is, if it's not the ingredients, then what the heck is it?
Right.
And my latest thought has been, well, they were making, in teams of three people, 1,500, 2,000 sheets in a day. They were making a lot of this stuff as a utilitarian commodity that was intended to go into daily use, be part of people's lives. And in the process of doing that, skilled workers produce paper that's very well made, but it has little thumbprints in the corner of the sheet. It has these little dings, these things that happen when you're in a hurry. So there's this tension between excellent workmanship and getting the job done, and that produces some of that character. So we've tried to replicate some of these production routines to see if we can get a little closer to that aesthetic. And it's funny because the students and I figured out, we did enough of this to realize we probably could make 150 to 200 sheets in an hour. And if you did that for 10 hours, then you could make 1,500 or 2,000 sheets in a day. And once I got to that point, I thought, well, this is good. This has really been interesting. And the students started saying, let's try. Uh-huh. Let's go ahead and try. And I said, try what? You know, Tim, make 2,000 sheets in a day. And so we did. I only made 1,350, but we're going to try again because we're trying to figure out how they were able to do this. I mean, it just increased tenfold once again our respect for these earlier workers. I mean, it's phenomenal what they did, and to devote their whole lives to it, you know, do that 6 days a week, most of their lives, is really something to imagine.
Yeah, wow. Okay, is there anything else you want to add?
No, well, I appreciate your coming. It's really been fun getting to know you a little better and hear your story, and we're glad you're able to take the time and come visit, and we welcome others coming to see what we're up to here, too.
Awesome. Thanks, Tim.
Sure.